I'm Martha Plimpton, and I'm in for Leonard Lopate. Perhaps the best-known work in English literature, Hamlet, the man and the play, are elusive, contradictory, and strange. And its influence on Western culture is pervasive. Author Simon Critchley, the Hans Jonas professor of philosophy at the New School for Social Research, and Jameson Webster, a psychoanalyst in private practice in New York City, explore the influence of this remarkable play and describe the various interpretations philosophers and psychoanalysts have had on it. Their book, Stay Illusion, The Hamlet Doctrine, is published by Pantheon Books, and I'm so happy it brings them here today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Why Stay Illusion? Aren't both the disciplines of philosophy and psychology about dispelling illusion, ultimately, and getting at the truth?
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, stay illusion is a line that Horatio says to the ghost, stay illusion.
Right.
So, but I mean, theatre is about illusion, and in many ways the play isn't so much about, the book isn't so much about philosophy or psychoanalysis explaining theatre, but it's about theatre as explaining philosophy and psychoanalysis. So, mm-hmm. We're very very pro-illusion.
Right. So is it possible to describe a single Hamlet doctrine or no? Isn't the beauty of the play that different people and different disciplines continue to discover other facets of it, other aspects?
I do think that you picked on something important in terms of the paradox of putting illusion sort of front and center. And even in psychoanalysis, there's something very important about holding on to illusion, that it's not that you pull the veil and look behind it and see the truth, but that it's a constant work of working with illusion, working with dreams, working with fantasies, working with desire. So even though there isn't one Hamlet doctrine per se, I think the theme of illusion runs throughout. And it wasn't us who titled it, it was our editor, Dan Frank, and he sort of pulled that title out. He saw something in the book that I think was really important, and I thank him for that.
How does one begin? How does one begin to psychoanalyze Hamlet of all people, of all creations, all characters?
I mean, one of the things I saw right away was the importance of Hamlet to the story of the birth of psychoanalysis. So we have these long chapters on the letters of Freud when he was sort of minting his theory, and he was talking to Wilhelm Fliess, who we think of as his quasi-analyst. And you see this powerful identification between Freud and Hamlet. Mm. And I think that you can't understand the Oedipus complex or what Freud was doing when he was talking about sexualities and dreams and inhibition and mourning without looking at this story. So it was that story that we wanted to tell as well as part of the book.
And also the Oedipus complex is kind of misnamed in the sense in which Oedipus gets to kill his father and sleep with his mother, whereas Hamlet doesn't. And for Freud, that's much more important. And when our desire is inhibited, and what Hamlet shows so powerfully is the inhibition of desire and the kind of distortions that can cause.
And how, the contradictions in character.
Mm-hmm. How can we learn what might be meant by the idea of psychoanalytic cure from Hamlet?
It's a negative picture, right? I mean, that's one of the things about Hamlet is that we see only the possibility of cure in the absolute negation of a certain kind of humanity. Mm-hmm. Right? We constantly play with this line that the play ends in a pile of corpses, but what it forces you to imagine, always in Shakespearean tragedies, is some other possibility, some different ethical life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's best witnessed in its negation because it forces your imagination, it forces a sort of elusive production.
Is that why you say that what is staged in Hamlet is very close to the experience of being a psychoanalyst?
So,
yeah. was Freud the first to link Hamlet to Oedipus?
As far as I know, he was. I mean, he was really excited about this discovery. He was writing letters to Fliess, and he was saying, you know, say something to me about what I have discovered. Mm-hmm. And we pick up this arrogance in an unpublished paper where he says it was left to me to unearth, you know, the mystery of Hamlet. Even if it's not entirely true, Freud certainly thought that it was true.
Mm, yeah. He was a confident guy in that way, but a lot of things.
He was a confident guy, that's right.
Who linked Hamlet to Antigone?
Well, Lacan. Mm. Lacan is another kind of figure in the book. Antigone is someone who acts on her desire, who goes right. with her desire all the way to death, and she's going to go through with it to the end. Whereas Hamlet is just inhibited. Mm-hmm. He cannot act. So the peculiar thing about Hamlet is that, you know, the play was known in its time often as Hamlet Revenge. Mm. So it's a good old-fashioned revenge tragedy, and you're going to see some blood, you're going to see some sword fights, mm-hmm. and it's also Shakespeare's longest play. Hamlet is the character in Shakespeare with the most lines, and he cannot revenge, he cannot act. Mm-hmm. So the kind of the enigma of the play is it's the fact that it's a revenge drama where we don't get the revenge until the very end, and even then it's kind of weird because he's already dead.
Right. So how does Hamlet show us the inhibiting consequences of repression? You talk about how he can't act on these things.
I mean, it's a great story about melancholia. Mm. You know, not just inhibition in character, which, from my perspective as an analyst, it's pervasive. We talk a lot about addictions or acting out or these kind of loosenings of inhibition, but I think underneath that is always inhibition. In my patients, and in my experience, there's a lot of inhibition. There's a lot of things that we can't do. Mm-hmm. So there's that aspect to it. But also in Hamlet, it's the inhibition of mourning in particular. Like, he can't confront loss. He can't accept the loss of his father. And it makes a very sort of powerful link between what it means to love and what it means to lose and what inhibition is trying to work against.
And yet, Hamlet, as you write, is not a very nice guy.
Right.
What would you say that he's a wolf in sheep's clothing a little bit?
A little bit of a wolf. I mean, he's a prince. People always forget that.
Right.
People think, I mean, the version of Hamlet that many people know is the Olivier Hamlet, which begins with the line, which isn't in the play, that this is the story of a man that cannot make up his mind. So we think of Hamlet as a nice guy
right.
with a heavy burden, which he's unable to carry out. And he's a prince. He's someone in a lofty social social position, and he's also mean.
Hmm.
He's mean, in particular, to Ophelia.
In
many ways, the way in which we turn the play is seeing it less as a play about Hamlet, but about Hamlet and Ophelia. And Ophelia is the play's real tragic casualty,
mm-hmm.
and that's also a casualty at the level of love. Right? Mm-hmm. Ophelia is the person who Hamlet loved, and he says in space of a couple of lines, I loved you. I loved you once, I loved you not.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern also, he's quite mean. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you'd use the word mean, but yeah.
Well, maybe they deserve it.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe they deserve it.
They might just be asking for it a little bit.
But he is, he's acting out constantly.
Right.
Using words, this endless kind of punning, this endless of use of language as a kind of screen between mm-hmm. him and the world. And so he is a strange kind of model for an authentic individual or whatever.
Like, he's almost an anti-Greek hero in that he's, using language and punning and games and all this and rumination,
Yeah.
But not acting on, he's sort of the opposite of Oedipus in that way.
Yeah.
You're right.
I mean, Oedipus, Oedipus doesn't know.
Right.
Oedipus thinks, because we begin Oedipus the king with, he thinks he's the solver of riddles, and then he finds out the truth about who he is, and he puts out his eyes and he's destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Hamlet knows everything from the beginning. The ghost tells him, and he cannot act. So it's a kind of anti-Oedipus, a kind of inverted Oedipus, and for that reason, perhaps a model for modern times.
I'm speaking with psychoanalyst Jameson Webster and professor of philosophy Simon Critchley about why Shakespeare's Hamlet still reverberates in our culture. Their book is called Stay Illusion, The Hamlet Doctrine. It's published by Pantheon, and we'll have more after the break. And coming up on the next Fresh Air, a conversation with journalist Alfredo Corchado. He's the Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, and he has covered issues that affect both sides of the border, like immigration and the reach of drug violence. Hear about it today at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. I'm Martha Plimpton, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from Berkeley, publisher of The Yard by Alex Grecian, a novel of Scotland Yard set in the dark atmosphere of late Victorian London after Jack the Ripper's reign of terror, now available in paperback. Montefiore Medical Center, the University Hospital for Albert Einstein College of Medicine, recognized among the best hospitals in New York by U.S. News & World Report, and dedicated to delivering world-class treatment and compassionate care. Learn more at inspiredmedicine.org.
New York City's own station, WNYC, in the city where more than 7 million people live in peace and enjoy the benefits of democracy.
WNYC, AM and FM.
Hi, I'm Martha Plimpton. I'm in for Leonard Lopate. You two are married.
Mm-hmm.
And and as you note in the book, Hamlet warns against that state, the state of marriage, saying to Ophelia, "I say we'll have no more marriage."
Mm-hmm.
I know this is a line that many people, particularly actors, laugh about. They think no more marriage is a very funny thing to say. Clearly, you haven't found that advice worth following. How did you interpret his advice on marriage from a philosophical or psychological point of view?
That's hard. Do you want to speak to that, Jameson?
I mean, we constantly play throughout the book with the fact that we're married, mm-hmm. and that there's sort of an injunction against families and against love and against continuing any familial line. I mean, the story of Hamlet is the story of the end of the Hamlet family.
Mm-hmm.
And we also put that in the context of Freud's idea that a discontent within marriage and within love and within desire is the story of modern civilization.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way we read it. And even Nietzsche, I mean, I wanted you to talk about sort of Nietzsche's hatred and disgust for familial relations.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, the moment that he tips over the edge, right?
The highest sign of vulgarity to feel oneself related to one's family.
Yeah.
It was more that it was an experiment. It was a mm-hmm. So the book to us is odd insofar as it feels incredibly intimate. We wrote it with each other, for each other, often on the floor in an almost sort of psychotic state.
Right.
You know, particularly towards the end, it was a kind of so. It really is hard to tell who said what when. So it is it is a kind of act of love about a guy in a play who's completely loveless.
And did you find it made your marriage stronger? Would you recommend it to others?
Yes, everybody should write a book on a Shakespeare tragedy. I think Macbeth next.
Did you have any strong disagreements about any interpretations of certain aspects of the play? Did you find yourselves butting heads at all? Or was it really just an open sort of co-dissection?
It was more of an accumulation, right? We accumulated things. The idea formed, and the idea formed, and then it became there's this and there's that and there's this. Then we began to associate and kind of we would discover more and more material. So it was more of a mutual accumulation of material, but also it was what's important. There's a kind of ventriloquism here. I mean, I'm a philosopher, and philosophers are meant to know what they say, and we have arguments and we say point one, point two, point three, and come to conclusions. I'm sort of sick to death of that, so I want to write in some other way.
Mm-hmm.
So writing in a sense with Jameson is an act of ventriloquism, trying to write with some other kind of voice that's less sort of, you know, less encumbered and less inhibited, if you like. So I find it very liberating, actually.
Yeah, we were joking around that there's a lot of points when we talk about a sort of transvestite Hamlet in the book, which has a long history.
Yes.
That people sort of believed that Hamlet was secretly a woman, or they thought
mm-hmm.
that he should be played by a woman, and indeed he was at several times.
Mm-hmm.
And that this act of mutual ventriloquism almost starts to play off of that theme that arises. And it's, of course, it's already there in Joyce, who, mm-hmm. with whom everything is already there.
So I'm assuming that each of you felt the play was important to both personally and professionally to undertake this book, which is a massive undertaking. Why Hamlet specifically?
That's tricky. I mean, it came to obsess us. It came to obsess us. I mean, you know, maybe
did it obsess you separately, and then you came to discover you both had obsessions, or did it sort of come upon you both at the same time, like a wave?
I had written about Hamlet in my first book.
Mm.
And I was particularly captivated by Lacan's interpretation. I mean, I really saw something new, in particular the way that he points out the violence of Hamlet. And then the two of us decided to teach it together as part of Simon's tragedy course at the New School for Social Research. And you started to look at Walter Benjamin and Schmidt and Hegel. And then I sort of saw this picture and I said, hey, what about this?
This would be a good little book. It was like a month or two to write, and it got out of hand.
That's a fun little thing to work on.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah, two years later, you know. But the book is, it's about the play. I mean, what I like about the book, looking at it, say, this morning, was that how much of the play that we quote. Mm-hmm. And there's the wonderful line in the introduction to the 1623 folio, mm-hmm. Hemming and Condell, whoever the editors of the folio, where they say, you know, we must read him again and mm-hmm. again and again. And in a sense, the book is about interpretations of Hamlet, but it's about the play.
Right.
And it's trying to push people back into the play and to try and shake up our expectations of what Shakespeare is about. There's a kind mm-hmm. of idea that Shakespeare is like Guinness, it's kind of good for you, mm-hmm. and it's an easy kind of moral message. And it's not, it's deeply, deeply disturbing. I mean, all the plays, Titus Andronicus mm-hmm. onwards, but Hamlet is a really weird play. And just to sort of follow that through is, you know, is fascinating. And so if we can get people to read him, then that would be an achievement for us.
You outline a lot of, or you touch on and write about a lot of different philosophers' takes on mm-hmm. Hamlet. And for a weird play, it's had some weird theories about it, too.
That's for sure.
But you mentioned Carl Schmitt. Describe a little bit about what he thought about this play.
Well, Schmitt had a very interesting idea, which was that there was...
Strange guy,
Nazi jury, not everybody's, you know, favorite dinner guest or whatever. But let's not go into. But he had this idea that there were two riddles in the play. Mm-hmm. One riddle is Hamlet's indecisiveness, mm-hmm. that he cannot decide what to do. And secondly, the riddle around the mother's guilt. Was Gertrude in on this or mm-hmm. not? And his explanation is a historical explanation. He says that Hamlet is a figure for James I of England, James VI of Scotland, whose mother, Mary Queen of Scots, bumped off her husband married her lover. So everybody knew this, which is mm-hmm. why Hamlet was such a success. It was a tragedy about the new king, and this was the backstory. Mm-hmm. So at the heart of Hamlet for Schmitt is a taboo.
Right.
And I don't think, you know, whether that's right or wrong, I don't know.
A conspiracy theory, perhaps, and all of that. Yeah.
But the point that it raises is the extraordinary kind of political importance of Hamlet. Right. You know, we think of Hamlet as this existential drama of indecision, whereas this is a political drama, and Hamlet is someone who is a prince in a world that is totally surveyed, a world of spies and a world of espionage, mm-hmm. and a kind of police state, which is a kind of mirror of the police state that Elizabethan England was in the late 16th century. So we try and bring up the political significance of the play. And there have been, you know, we were asked a few months ago to do a little showing of Hamlet with some friends, and we struggled as to which version to use. And we ended up using this version by the Soviet version from the director Kozintsev. Mm-hmm.
Shostakovich did the score for it. It's amazing.
Yeah, and it's a Soviet Hamlet. It's like an anti-Olivier political Hamlet.
Right. Every scene is filled with people. So they completely undo the idea that Hamlet is this solitary figure trapped in his own mind. Mm-hmm. And even when he's doing his monologues, it's him in a room with other people, and it's a voiceover. It's probably the one time that I've seen a voiceover work in a film. And he's constantly leaving the castle, and there's tons of people on the outside.
So it's this strange mixture of the, you know, the psychological and the political in Hamlet.
And who is spying on whom?
Everybody's spying on everybody.
Yeah.
You know, everybody, you know, because we get this line that people know, to thine own self be true, that Polonius says to Laertes. Mm-hmm. He sends him off to Paris, back to Paris. Next scene, you know, we find Polonius with a spy. One Reynaldo is going to be sent off to Paris to spy on Laertes. And not just spy, but to tell nasty stories about Laertes, to find out nasty truth about. And every character is being watched. Ophelia is being watched when mm-hmm. she dies.
So do you think it's fair to say that the frame of Hamlet is essentially war? I mean, this warlike
Absolutely.
State and all of this,
Everything is about preparations for war and the kind of paranoia of war, you know?
Right.
And the history, because there's Hamlet Sr. and Fortinbras Sr., and there was a war between them.
Mm-hmm.
So you always have that backstory that's really important to remember.
And the play ends with a foreign occupation. The play ends with Hamlet dying and saying, I give my dying voice. The election lights on Fortinbras. Mm-hmm. So the play ends with an occupation of Denmark by a foreign power, namely Norway. Mm-hmm. So it's political at every level.
In the book, you write that it's no exaggeration to say that philosophy began as a problem philosophers had with theater. Mm-hmm. How so?
Well, I mean, the important example, of course, is that philosophy begins, the ideal philosophical community is one in which tragedy and theater is banished.
Right. And why? How did Plato describe the conflict that he had with theater? Why tragedy in particular?
Well, because he was, you know, because tragedy was basically
fake
tragedy.
Emotions.
Yeah, it was producing fake emotions. Tragedy was kind of the, you know, the reality TV, the spectacle of the Athenian city, and Plato wants to replace that with a new discourse, namely philosophy. So in order to have a philosophically well-ordered city, the tragic poets were the first people that had to be got rid of.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always been this kind of weird relationship between philosophy as a discourse on truth and theatre as a discourse on untruth.
Or illusion.
And, yeah, an illusion. And we really give the we give the last word to theatre.
I love that. I like giving the last word to theatre too.
Absolutely.
I'm a strong believer in always giving the theatre the last word. I've been speaking with psychoanalyst Jameson Webster and professor of philosophy Simon Critchley about their book, Stay Illusion, The Hamlet Doctrine. It's published by Pantheon. Simon and Jameson will be speaking and signing books tonight at 7 p.m. at Powerhouse Arena, 47 Main Street in Brooklyn. They'll also be in conversation with Hari Kunzo at McNally Jackson. Right?
McNally Jackson.
On Thursday, July 11th at 7 p.m. Information to both events is on our show page at WNYC.org. Jameson and Simon, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you both. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Martha.